From the newsrooms of WBUR and GBH, I'm Arun Roth. Welcome to Consider This, from Boston, where when the pandemic began, there were worries that colleges and universities would be hotbeds of COVID-19 transmission. In reality, experts say many schools have been models for containing the virus. With the fall semester approaching, one key strategy is mandating vaccinations. GBH's Gabriella Emanuel has been reporting on what this means for the city's international students. She joins me now. Hi, Gabriella.
Hi there.
So in the U.S., COVID vaccines are widely available now, it seems, to just about anybody who wants one, but that's not the case in other countries. What does that mean then for international students who have to get the shot before coming to campus?
So it means that things can be challenging. One thing that makes it even more challenging is that each university and college is basically having to come up with their own rules and regulations around this issue. So some schools like Tufts and BU are saying all vaccines count. Whatever vaccine you can get access to, it counts, whether it's coming out of Russia, China, even Cuba. And their point is that there's promising data coming from around the world. But other schools like Northeastern, Boston College, Harvard, Brown, they're telling international students, do get access to whatever you can get access to. But if that vaccine is not approved by the FDA or the WHO, then we will help you get revaccinated. So get another FDA-approved vaccine once you are on campus.
Okay, here's a new term, revaccination. So somebody who has had a vaccine will get another vaccine on top of that. Is that good for people?
Yeah, that's the question. So a bunch of schools are doing or are kind of promoting this revaccination approach, and they're actually following the CDC guidelines. And when I spoke to students, they said they were actually really glad the CDC finally weighed in on this issue of vaccines coming from around the world. Here's Vanessa Brito of Brown University. She's the executive director of health and wellness there.
At one point, we weren't really sure what we would do about some of the other vaccines that were being offered around the world. And so we were really grateful to get the guidance of the CDC.
So while the CDC did put out guidance, it acknowledged in a statement to GBH News that there isn't actually definitive data yet on whether getting vaccinated again with another vaccine is safe or effective.
So given that there is no definitive data, is there a debate around whether this is the right thing to do?
There is a debate. And some are saying, is it ethical to ask or suggest your students should inject something potentially unnecessary into their arms? And as you said, there isn't definitive clinical trials. And here's Michael Minna of Harvard's School of Public Health on this topic.
We don't want to force college students coming in from abroad to get onto universities to be the guinea pigs for those trials.
Minna says if enough other people on campus are vaccinated, like basically all the American students, then you don't have to worry too much if just kind of a small number of people have a somewhat subpar vaccine. But others, like immunologist David Lieb at Dartmouth College, came to a different conclusion. He said basically that there's no immunological reason to believe that getting vaccines from two different countries, two different vaccines, is dangerous. And the very earliest studies that are beginning to come out on mixing and matching suggest it's safe.
It doesn't seem that revaccination with any of the vaccines that are available has any adverse effects and only seems to have beneficial effects. So I would probably land on the side of yes, it wouldn't be a bad thing to get revaccinated.
So it really is. It's an ongoing topic of debate.
So before we let you go, tell us what the experts, the epidemiologists and so on, what are they most concerned about as we plan for the fall semester?
So two things I'll leave you with. First is they say the critical window for making sure there aren't big outbreaks on college campuses is those first week or two when students and everyone else starts arriving on campus. They say that because this is kind of a short-term respiratory virus and not something long-term like HIV, it's that little window of time, those first week or two, that you need to be doing lots and lots of testing. And the second thing they say is there is a huge wild card here, and that is whether there's another variant come the fall, especially one that can kind of dodge the vaccines. So they say, these experts, these epidemiologists, immunologists, they say that universities need to be making plans for that scenario, even though, of course, everyone hopes a new variant doesn't surface by the fall.
Super interesting. Gabriella, thank you.
Thank you.
That's GBH's Gabriella Emanuel. Before we go, I should tell you what else is up. Two of the men involved in an armed standoff with police that shut down Interstate 95 in Wakefield were back in court today. Police say a group of 11 men carrying guns and wearing body armor claimed to be en route to training in Maine. The men are members of a Rhode Island-based Black Sovereign Citizen group called Rise of the Moors. Mark Pitcavage is a senior research fellow at the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism. He says the Moors believe they are not U.S. citizens and are not beholden to any U.S. laws.
Perhaps the easiest way to think of the sovereign citizen movement is as right-wing anarchists. They seek a nominal government that is, in effect, no government at all, so that nobody or nothing has any authority over them, and they can do whatever they want, however they want.
Pitcavage says the movement began around 1970 and first came to public attention in the 1980s during the farm crisis.
The sovereign citizen movement has a long-standing association with violence, up to and including shootouts, armed standoffs, murders, and terrorist plots and attacks. Every year, sovereign citizens kill people in the United States. In many years, at least one of those persons killed will be a police officer.
Today, the movement boasts about 300,000 people, according to Pitcavage, and is high on the FBI's domestic terrorism watch list. In other news, Governor Charlie Baker and Democratic state lawmakers appear to be at odds over how to decide when and where to spend the state's budget surplus as the Commonwealth receives billions in federal aid. Baker wants to spend much of the state's $5 billion in federal relief on housing, jobs, and infrastructure, while Democratic leaders prefer to hold hearings and determine where lawmakers want that money to go. Baker's administration and finance secretary, Mike Heffernan, says legislators share many of the governor's goals and will work out a compromise after hearings later this month.
That a lot of what we're proposing are shared ideas and shared goals. And I think that they truly do want to have a process and a say in how we, you know, in how we design these programs and how we implement these programs going forward.
As for the estimated surplus of nearly $1 billion, the Republican governor is still floating his idea of an extended two-month sales tax holiday. Democrats have flatly rejected that idea and say they want to spend the money on services. And finally, Massachusetts is trying a new strategy to boost the population of bats, which has been decimated by a fungal disease called white nose syndrome. Bats can contract the disease in the caves and mines where they spend winter. Five species in the Commonwealth are now endangered, so the state has installed 30 man-made bat houses that are free of the syndrome. Bats are beneficial for a variety of reasons. Among them, they consume over half their body weight in insects each night during the warm seasons. Some species consume up to their entire body weight in insects, many of which are pests to us. Officials plan to install another 20 bat houses statewide. From the newsrooms of WBUR and GBH, the greatest combo since more bats and fewer mosquitoes, I'm Arun Roth. Be well. Before you go, let me tell you about Nova Now, a new bi-weekly podcast from the PBS science series Nova. Join host Alok Patel as he explores the science behind the biggest headlines of the day. Now is more critical than ever to distinguish fact from fiction and find science-based answers to the most pressing questions of our time. Subscribe to Nova Now wherever you get your podcasts.